And there we go. Hello, everyone. We're in a different studio recording today, so it's making things a little weird. Anyway, I should probably explain who we are and everything.
Yes, that would be great, Adam. A. Donaldson.
Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, as previously mentioned, and joining me today is...
Scotty Hertz here from the Helen Hambly Studio in beautiful CFRU.
I wish. I think that's enough banter for...
beautiful or was
yeah,
it?
Let's move on with the show.
We love it.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, and or the Stitcher and Google Play. I lost track there, but that's all right. We'll recover as the show goes on. Today, the strike may be over, but the headaches remain. We'll look at the end of the college workers' strike here in Ontario and all the last minute politicking that took place. And let's not forget the fate of the students in all of this. And then Keystone XL looks ready to roll, but there may be new legal flies in the ointment, and a leak in North Dakota is unlikely to silence any objections from the tree hugger folks, and we'll talk about those latest developments. And then finally, Toronto is trying something new to help the 50,000 some odd people who use streetcars down King Street every day to get to where they're going, and they're going a lot quicker now. And we're going to talk about whether that's a success or the end of civilization as we know it, depending on who you ask, Doug Ford. And then, first of all, the icky state of affairs south of the border, and here in Canada to a certain extent, because that's back in the news as well a little bit. But, I mean, we'll have to deal with the especially icky stuff in the United States, with particular emphasis on Alabama. And in case you are unawares, the Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, who is looking to fill the seat of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, now Attorney General.
Okay, Jeff Sessions.
Yeah. I prefer Beauregard.
Beauregard. I should have gone with that.
Cast him in a perfect light. But enough about Beauregard. Roy Moore is the person we're talking about today, and we're going to get to some other people as well. But he's not being famous... he's now more famous, I should say, for being an alleged pervert than being the nutcase that was thrown off the state Supreme Court twice. And that seems to be where we're at in politics.
Yeah, you might know of Judge Roy Moore. He was the guy best known for the Ten Commandments in granite. He was known as the Ten Commandments judge. He had this copy of them made and put in front of the judicial building in Alabama to great acclaim from some and from others who believe in the separation of church and state and all those things that make America what it is.
Not so much.
But beyond that, see, broken one or two of the usual commandments. He's one of these, like, theological guys who hates the gays and thinks the Muslims shouldn't hold elected office. But it would seem that he has a thing, allegedly, for young women. And over the years, it has come out now, which is being said to be political smear tactics or whatever. But the evidence is overwhelming that something was going on. In fact, I read a little bit of a something today that one of the former police officer down that way is retired, and this man would have nothing to gain by saying what he said was, oh, yeah, I got to watch out for Moore, especially at the mall there, because he likes young women.
Other than that, there's apparently a police officer on the record who lives in his hometown, which I think it's Gadden, Alabama, who was on duty at the high school games. Because apparently he would go there and hit on the cheerleaders.
Oh.
And that's so gross.
Yeah, but you can think back in the day, be like, oh, that Roy, oh, he's such a whatever, this and that. And
yeah.
Everybody looked the other way because he was in a position of power and privilege. And now it's all this. So they're saying the usual stuff. Trump has taken his side, obviously. It's a plot from the Democrats. And Moore is saying this is like false and desperate stuff.
Yeah,
but I think it's at least seven women claiming have said that something has happened now.
Yeah.
It sounds like some form of molestation to varying degrees. So it's one of those things where, at this point, I don't think Moore has a hope of getting elected, although wouldn't put it past him. But it sounds, you know, there are Republicans and others coming out against him. Mitch McConnell, I think, is one who have said, look, we got to get rid of this guy. But it's too late in the game, because if he did step down at this point, his name would still be on the ballot, but it wouldn't be. And then there was some sort of theory or something proposed that they should just put Jeff Sessions on the ballot again, which would make absolutely no sense.
As a write-in, that there would be some sort of universal campaign. Instead of voting Roy Moore, if you want to vote Republican, write in Jeff Sessions, write in Beauregard's name, and you will then effectively keep that seat in Republican hands. And although I think Sessions himself has ruled that out, because he's doing far more damage for the quote-unquote greater good as Attorney General than he's one of the actual few effective members of the Trump cabinet who's enacting the agenda, the horrid agenda such that it is, but he's enacting the agenda. And and I think this is kind of what he's always wanted anyway, and one of the reasons why he threw in with Trump is because he knew Trump would put him in a role where he could do these things that he wants to do, like more private prisons, more harsh tactics against black people, brown people, what have you. So that seems a very unlikely likelihood.
And this is one of the things with the severe evangelicals, I'll call them, but the extreme believers in the South, is that they belief kind of overwhelms their thought processes in some ways, and they have this, it's always that they're being persecuted somehow, as opposed to before they would believe any victim, alleged or otherwise. And I thought the weirdest thing come out of this was, I don't remember who made the comparison between, well, with Mary and Joseph, Mary was only 14 and Joseph was a well-aged carpenter or something. I'm like, really? This is where you're going to take that?
Yeah.
What if it was your daughter, right? They never go to that. It's like, well, he's a man of faith, so you know, we need to...
Glossing over the fact it was an immaculate conception to begin
exactly.
with. Exactly. You think you would get at least, you know, if you're that big of a Bible thumper, you would have managed to walk away with at least that much. Mm-hmm. The politicking around this is so bizarre, and I saw it again today on CNN with... somebody from the Florida caucus, a Republican congressman, who's like, here's what you do. You vote for Roy Moore, they're not going to let him sit in the Senate. So he's going to get expelled, and the Republican governor of Alabama is going to appoint a Republican. So we keep it. It's all good. Oh. And this is like the level of strategizing and politicizing they're doing. Instead of saying the majority of Republicans who voted for this guy to be their representative in the senatorial election, they blew it. They screwed up. Vote your conscience. Vote for the guy. Doug Jones is his name, the Democrat. Most famous for putting the last of the Klansmen that killed the four little girls who were murdered in the church in 1963. He put the last of those Klan members behind bars, which is so hilarious when you have Trump going, we need somebody who's going to be tough on law and order. It's like, well, how about the guy who's put Klansmen in jail for killing black girls in the 1960s.
That was the incident that pretty much kicked off the civil rights movement, wasn't it? And of course, Trump is like, terrible record, terrible, everything is a terrible guy. I was like, really? He has way more of a record than you ever had, Presidente. So, yikes.
I mean, he has a record of actual accomplishment, unlike Donald Trump. But that's neither here nor there. The thing is, this is the same kind of dirty politics that Mitch McConnell himself, and he's kind of the one driving, like, we got to keep the Senate seat. Why? Because looking at the 2018 races, there's only maybe two Senate seats that are considered vulnerable, and that is in Nevada and Arizona, which are now technically purple states. So the Democrats are looking at them as imminently flippable. But that still only brings it to 50. Now, Republicans would technically keep the Senate in that instance because Mike Pence would come in and break every tie. But if this does end up getting flipped at the Alabama seat, I mean, that looks to give Democrats the tip to getting a 51-seat majority in the Senate, which means everything in the Trump agenda stops.
Yeah.
And so there's a, you know, In the midst of Mitch McConnell saying, well, I believe the women and I'm not a turtle, he's sweating under the collar big time, because he knows. I mean, this is why they're also ratcheting up with all these crazy judges that they're naming for judges.
This is pretty much season one of House of Cards without the murders, isn't it? The murders that we don't know about.
Well,
we can't really watch House of Cards now.
Let's not get into Alex Jones territory.
Goodness gracious.
But, I mean, this is more than a Republican problem, and we did want to address this all over because you have people like Charlie Rose now. Charlie Rose mm-hmm. is banished from TV because
erased.
I think he's up to seven or eight accusers now. You have Al Franken, and Al Franken seems like a unique case because he's had the one accuser, Leanne Tweeden, and that seemed to come and go, but now another woman has come forward saying that he groped her during the Minnesota State Fair in 2010. But it's a bit different because he has called and is on the receiving end of an ethics investigation into himself. There hasn't been the deluge. This seems to have been the pattern, whether it's Harvey Weinstein or Roy Moore or Charlie Rose, that one, two, three, or four people come out. And then you somehow get up into the double digits within a day. Or someone like James Toback, who I think that original story in the LA Times had like maybe a dozen witnesses. But then the reporter said the next day he had like 300 people leaving messages on his phone. So that seems to be the pattern. So, you know, whether or not – I mean, it's still sketchy for Al Franken. And we don't want to take it easy on him because he's on the left side of things. But
yeah, the thing with that initial – accusation, I think it happened on a USO tour, so would they go and entertain the troops? I believe it was Iraq. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the first thing to come out was a picture of what's her last name again?
Leanne Tweeden.
Leanne Tweeden grabbing one of the performer's bums during a performance. And I don't know if it was part of the shtick or whatever, but, you know, there seems to be, not to dismiss her accusation completely, because there's obviously been others have come down the pipe, but it sounds like some of what was going on. But of course, the thing with Franken is that the picture that's making
the picture. Yeah,
I mean that picture is like, you know, one of those 1,000-word pictures where you're like, oh boy, like what is going on there? You know, let's find the context of this, and it's
almost as damning as that Access Hollywood tape, just because. There's kind of a shock moment where you like someone just said that, someone just did that,
And yet he became the president somehow.
Yeah, and then speaking of, there's John Conyers, who is a Democrat from Michigan in the Congress. And apparently, you know, this is getting into particularly, you know, damaging workplace legal stuff. But apparently, he had somebody sign like a NDA or some sort of, you know, agreement that said, you know, we're going to give you money because we don't want you to go to court, and there's all this come out in the open about me harassing you allegedly, and then that gets especially, I think, icky, and it gets, and because that's something that Harvey Weinstein did too, is that
and he had a hit list of people, didn't he? He's like, oh, this person. Funny enough, some of the people on that list are the ones that have been vocal, very vocal, about Rose McGowan.
Yep.
For one, among others who have been, so there's definitely a pattern there not to be dismissed. And you may wonder why we keep saying allegedly. It's for legal reasons. Regardless of what our personal opinions are,
cover.
This is, you know, you can probably fish out what our political opinions are on this or whatever our opinions are on this, but allegedly means, you know, not.
It hasn't been proven in a court of law.
Not proven in a court of law, but this is the thing. A lot of, the, you know, this. It's the people's court that's taking care of most of this. In fact, I'd heard it. Al Franken was in some kind of special, supposed to be for David Letterman getting an award. He was like erased
Kennedy
from
honors,
it.
Yeah.
Completely erased. His presence has been removed from it. So.
Yeah, understandable given the circumstances. I don't think he's been seen in public since, or he hasn't done anything public or
no.
really kind of and walked this is, around.
I think we're going to see more of that. We've spoken about in the past Jimmy Savile, who was a notorious molester in the UK. It came out after he had passed away, and it was like hundreds and hundreds of people of all ages. And there's still lots of stuff online where, because he was a music host, so they'd be like, he's introducing bands and that. I was like, why isn't somebody getting in there and just scrubbing the guy? Because he really, really needs to go. So, we'll see. It's pretty much been somebody every day, right?
Yeah.
In the past, what, 2-3 weeks? Yeah. It was Weinstein, and then it was like the gates open. So I don't think they're going to close anytime soon. This won't
be the
last.
Weinstein, and then it felt like There were a couple of other people, and then Spacey came out, and then that felt like it really ratcheted out. And it has seemed like someone new every day.
But then we had hints of it last year with Cosby and Gomeshi 2 years ago.
Gomeshi, sure. And the thing I found particularly disturbing is there was a couple of Congress people, Barbara Comstock and Jackie Spears, who just last week were saying, even before the Franken thing, is like, this is something that needs to be addressed inside the halls of Congress. And Jackie Spears, who's a California congresswoman, said that there were a couple of congressmen she knew that were sitting congressmen that were guilty of some stuff. And it turned out that John Conyers isn't one of them.
Oh.
Because they asked her, was John Conyers one of the two? And she's like, no, I'm shocked by it too. And Jackie Spears is someone I want to give a shout out to some of the Democratic congresswomen. Jackie Spears is someone who's seen some things. She was at Jonestown it all went bad. She was on the congressional staff of the senator who was killed there.
Oh, wow.
So and she was shot several times and survived. So she's seen some things. Mm-hmm. Her and like Dianne Feinstein's been getting a lot of crap because she's still a centrist Democrat, but you know, she was in San Francisco City Hall the day Harvey Milk died. I think she was the acting mayor after the mayor there was killed. So, you know, these are tough women.
Seasoned, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of tough women, that may have been a bad segue because I forget where we're going. Right, the college strike. Well, Deb Matthews is a tough woman. She's the minister in charge of colleges and universities and training. I think I got the order of that mixed up, but we'll proceed. They had a special vote last weekend. Queens Park sat on the weekend. But
that's why they were all angry, because they had to go to work on the weekend.
But yeah, so they are back to work now, and the college teachers and sessionals and instructors and librarians, several thousand employees of the Ontario college system, 24 colleges in all, back to work. This is after a 5-week strike, an epic long strike. Scotty, you are the labor expert.
Still the labor reporter
of us
at this station.
So, you know, how are you feeling about being, you know, legislated back to work and all these things, all these hanging chads being left in the air?
Well, it's one of those things in general where, at least on the labor side of the equation, it's always better to come up with a solution at the table. And it would seem that the overtures that were made by OPSU and the workers during the strike was, let's get back to the table. It was a picture making the rounds of them sitting in what I believe to be the negotiating room, and the other side were just not there. Mm-hmm. That's never good. And then there was one point where Smokey Thomas said, yes, we called them. And then the head of the College Employer Council was like, oh, I didn't get that message. It's like, that's your answer? Really? That you didn't get the memo? Like, that is unacceptable, considering what was at stake here, because now it's going to be settled by binding arbitration and mediation. And for those who don't know what that is, it's, I would call it quasi-judicial. It's not really a judge per se, but a mediator, arbitrator comes on board. The parties still come together as they would have in negotiations, sit down, come up with it, and whatever the arbitrator / mediator, it seems now they've kind of merged this title, whatever comes out of that is what will stand, and for whatever period they decide for it to be. Now, the thing is, it would seem that one of the last outstanding things that was preventing an agreement was academic freedom.
Yeah.
And just in my personal opinion, I don't think something like academic freedom is something that you can strike on. I think that people, workers of all sorts, union, non-union, would look at that and say, really, that's what, you know, you're going to get almost 8% raise. You're getting all this, this, and this, but you're still out on academic freedom. To me personally, it seems like a bit of a weak reason. And this is me, I guess, coming from somebody who's been on the labor side of the table. Like, all the things that they were looking for in terms of precarious workers and part-time profs not getting the pay and recognition that they should get.
Because that was what the strike was being sold as.
Yes,
about,
and that's a huge part of it too, and that's happening across academia. It's not just colleges, it's here at the universities.
Yeah.
And of course, all that is driving it. I can give an example, comparatively administration versus people who are part-time. It would seem the example given was 72% of the professors at Algonquin College. 72%, so three-quarters are part-time. But yet, you may have heard it was the president of Algonquin College was looking for a 50% pay hike, which would have taken her up to like $445,000 a year.
She would have been the richest person in Northern Ontario.
Yes. Well, the top of
that's
the car.
Maybe a bit over.
No, that's, well, it's entirely, yeah. Plus, you get a free car. She seems yeah, she yeah. has a Lexus. Lexus is the car of choice.
Sick.
Free parking, probably.
Meanwhile, have a free car without free parking.
Well, of course. But especially a flash car like that, you got to park close to the building so no one will scratch it.
That's exactly right.
But meanwhile, you know, on the student side too, tuition over the past, I think the period is 15 years, has tripled.
Mm.
Debt is, student debt is at an all-time high. And I think that's why some of the people are saying with this $500 expense offset, I'm saying the people, but I mean students in general, all of it seems the plums, I guess, that the government's offering up is $500 expense offset. You know, if you had to pay for childcare or extra transportation or whatever. And if you had OSAP, it's like it's kind of forgiven by the sounds of it for this semester. And what was the other thing? The support fund and that. There was something else.
They're letting people get out of
you
the
can
semester.
Drop out. That's right. That's what it is.
You have, a week from Monday or a week from Tuesday to say whether or not you want to stick it out. And
you can drop out with no penalty and kind of reset.
Get a refund.
Reset your semester.
Yeah.
But that $500, I mean, I saw Patrick Brown, he was like, I think it should be double. I think it should be $1,000. And I was like, what?
Yeah, he said the government should match.
Like double. The one
like
I saw
the
was he said double.
Unconservative thing I've ever heard a conservative politician say.
He's just saying stuff at this point, which is how he rolls, but like we do every week. No, but yeah, so it's somebody on the call, and from day one, people were blaming the government for this. You also need to understand that the College Employer Council is kind of hands-off from the government can legislate them back to work because the colleges are within the purview of the provincial government.
Right.
The College Employer Council, and I found a heck of a time, I was not able to find anybody who was sitting on the negotiating team for the College Employer Council side. I couldn't. I looked pretty hard, relatively hard. And that's unusual because normally you could say, oh, it's the premier on the other side of the table or it's the Minister of Ed, Deb Matthews, right, or whatever.
Yeah.
That somebody from that negotiating team said, I don't understand why OPSU didn't accept the demands on day one. It was like, well, because that's not how negotiations work. Negotiations is a bit of a waltz, right? It's like this give and take and – that's how it normally goes, but they just, I don't know why they won't accept this. That to me speaks to, and once again, just in my opinion, there's obviously a bit of inexperience on that side of the table because it doesn't work that way. It's a dance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't, this is where you come up with like, oh, they have to accept this. It's like, well, there's a procedure in place how this works. You can't just say, okay, you need to vote on this. You need to get back to work. It's like, everybody wants that, but then procedurally you have to do this, this, and this. Then that will happen.
Well, I feel like the government was in a difficult position in terms of, you know, when they could legislate back to work. I think they waited as long as they possibly could, maybe even longer. And we had Catherine McGarry on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
She said, you know, they had talked about it in caucus.
Oh, for sure.
And that it, you know,
talked about it every day, probably.
Yeah, that it was on top. It was on top of mind for them.
But also they don't want to kind of disrupt the, let's say, the labor side of the equation either. You don't want
the natural order. Yeah,
because there isn't an affinity or an affiliation with the teachers, whether official or not. That you know they lean towards the Liberal NDP realm politically. They never outwardly say okay, vote for them, but.
Well, there's a push-pull between NDP and Liberal for teacher support. NDP is the friend the teachers want. Liberals are the friends that they need because
they have.
Yeah.
That pull the strings, actually.
That's certainly more friendly and more likely to have power, let's say.
But then, of course, the way it was teed up is that, it's the NDP's fault that this failed. It's like, well, not really. I mean, it may be their fault that it lasted for two or three more days, knowing full well that the back to work legislation is going to go through.
It's the NDP's fault the kids went back Tuesday instead of Monday.
Yes. Oh, boo hoo, right? It's like at least they're back, right? So,
I do wonder, though. I think Andrea Horvath phrased it as kind of like a procedural matter of we have to get, you know, people back to, or we have to read the legislation before we can vote on it, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
And the thing that they had to have the debate because the Liberals could have theoretically just passed it Thursday night if all the parties just ascended to just passing without reading and without debate. And the NDP's like, no, we're going to have a debate, which is fine, which is a perfectly tenable position. I do wonder how this is going to jibe with the way Andrea Horvath is going to campaign, because I think the Andrea Horvath that campaigned in 2014 would have, you know, just let it go and let people get back to work, or make people get back to work.
Yeah.
And I wonder what her political calculus is, because you're right, it was going to pass anyway.
Yeah. If this is anything to go by, I think they're going to go left, or let's say more left than they were the last time. Because they were definitely riding the center the last time. The problem is, at least the situation is, that they have the same leader. It's not as if there's fresh blood at the top. So is it going to be, are they going to get the same thing, you know, the full page wraparound in the Toronto Sun, or is it going to be, you know, Labor Day Extreme, whatever. But also, you know, it wasn't beyond the Liberals using this for politicking. I looked at the government website explaining what the procedure was going to be for the students, the $500, this and that. But they slid right into the politics. It's like, well, we want to have a higher minimum wage and better working conditions for the workers of this province. There's a whole paragraph dedicated to Liberal policy. I'm like, this is not the place for that.
No.
That's not where that belongs. If you want to say it when you're doing your, you know, 2 minutes in front of the microphones or less, that's one thing. But I read it and I'm like, why are you sticking this in here, man? Like, sorry, well, that was just my gut reaction was like,
no,
there's this politicking in this very serious issue. It's like, well, we want to improve this and that. And there were things in there that are really nothing to do with the situation.
No, you're not wrong. And I think Kathleen Wynne wanted to play it off as like some sort of King Solomon thing. Like they had this great wisdom of like, this is like the exact moment we're going to legislate people back to work. It's, you know, we've had enough and it's time for the students to get back to work. It's like, no, if you'd kind of let it go on any longer, it was, I mean, there was that tension, I think, with the college students. Like, are we ever going to get back to school? Are we ever going to get back in class? Like, what's going to happen with our tuition? What's going to happen with our semester? Because I saw kids on the news last night or Tuesday night saying, you know, we were going to have 5 assignments. Now we have 2 assignments that are
long.
both worth the same amount
as
the 5 assignments. And so the pressure's on for them, and they're going to have to stay into their Christmas vacation. And Patrick Brown is, you know, I question his motives, but I mean, he is right that, you know, $500 maximum doesn't seem very, very,
it's not a lot.
Accommodating, considering that, you know, when you're talking about college, you're also not talking about universally a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds. You're also talking about middle-aged people. You're talking about parents. You're talking about married couples, mature students, people who are squeezing in re-education with jobs, re-education with family commitments. So it's, you know, it's a great big broader swath of the community that are enrolled in these college programs. And yeah, it's, you know, $500 might be a boon to some of the kids out in the hallway there near Christmas time, but, you know, for the others, you know, maybe not so much.
I think the Conservatives would have legislated them back to work within a week. That's my analysis. But he can say whatever he likes about doubling this and that, and it's about the students. It's like, well, it's about the students until you make it purely political. So,
you know, Patrick Brown tries really hard.
He does try really hard. I wonder how he'll try as premier, but that's for another day.
Ooh, good way to tee up the people.
Is it segue time?
Is it music time? It is music time.
Right on.
I'm not sure how that segues into the music, but
the Patrick Brown band. I don't know.
I wish.
Patrick Watson.
I wish there was a Patrick Brown band. I almost feel like there has to be. I feel like he would have one of those, like, 24, Van Catra was Stephen Harper's band, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Like,
I feel I feel like Patrick Brown is due for one of those, like, do like a Beatles cover band.
Banging out Hey Jude or whatever.
As long as it's not... I'm not going to get into Paul Ryan and his apparent love of Rage Against the Machine, because that's weird.
Oh, yeah, and they said, you can't like our band. You're not allowed to like us.
Well, we hope you like this band, and then we'll be right back with some more items from this week's news. You're listening to Open Source as well if you're on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and community radio.
Yeah. People say, where are you from? And I tell them D.C. But I can say European, it's just as easy. But I can say Mother Earth, cause if you break it down, we were the ones who put every border on the ground. We made religion for good, but now it separates. We made words so everybody communicates. But now the language is hatred and it is blame too. We are all immigrants, sorry for the bad news. Always an issue, and it's always a problem. We need solutions.
And we're back.
That was Poetry in Motion. Or the band is Soja.
The band is Soja.
The song is Poetry in Motion. I got this, that.
The album is Poetry in Motion.
The album is Poetry in Motion. Wouldn't that be a good band name, though? Wouldn't it? Poetry
the song. Yeah, the song is Bad News. So.
And they're playing the Mod Club in Toronto on March 9th, 2018. We're just saying they're really working in advance because we don't normally get 3 months ahead of now.
We don't get
4 months, actually.
4 month head dub about a show coming to Toronto.
Check them out.
No news of a Guelph date, sadly.
No, I don't think it's happening, but.
So bad news seemed apropos because, you know, it's always bad news. But it's perhaps bad news for the Keystone Pipeline, of all things. But on a week, it was supposed to be a successful celebration of finally connecting the pipelines. Because I think we forget that the Keystone Pipeline isn't just something that's waiting to be built. It's something that has been built in pieces. They're just waiting for the final sort of connective tissue that runs through Nebraska that will connect the oil sands in Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. And thus, away we go with sending our bitumen through the North American continent. Though, again, what was supposed to be an occasion for celebration on Monday, the Nebraska Public Service Commission, yes, they voted green light for the pipeline, but they voted for the third alternative, which a lot of people are high-fiving about because apparently that means they can start the legal and protest and all the stuff to kind of end the pipeline all over again.
Open up the gates. Yeah, it sounds like I don't know that this pipeline will be any less spilly than the one that's there. What was yeah. the spill on the weekend? 800,000 liters or 500?
It was 500.
5,000 barrels, 800,000 yeah. liters leak in yeah. South Dakota in the existing line.
Yeah.
As if on cue. It yeah. was like days before this commission decided.
They could not have timed it better.
And it was underground, so of course it doesn't look as bad, but you probably saw the drone footage of the black ooze in the farmer's field. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to clean it up. Yeah, no problem.
Oh, that's so gross. It's heinous.
Yeah, it gets right down in there, and the farm surrounding area, it's never, ever right. So today's news, I've heard with the up and down, the seesaw of the price of crude. Today it's up. At $58, and it sounds like that's due to lower oil sands production. So, of course, that means we need another pipeline. And reduced inventory in the United States. Now, I believe the break-even number, or at least the functional number for any tar oil sands production is $55. So the margins aren't that high. It's the price of crude is kind of flatlined, but, of course, I wouldn't say everybody wants the pipeline. It's going to have a bit of a deke in it now. It's something like 5 extra miles of pipeline. Interestingly, the fours include Rachel Notley. Mm-hmm. NDP Premier has endorsed it. She said, quote, "It will bring more Alberta oil to the world." And, of course, Jason Kenney has to chime in and say, "Notley hasn't done enough. She hasn't done enough." I wouldn't say shocked, but considering what's going on next door in BC, how anti-pipeline the tone is, and I think that's what Kenny's talking about. Kenny is saying, "Oh, you need to put BC right and get that pipeline through BC and get the oil to going in that direction as well.
Good, get the oil."
He's trying to tar sand Notley with an anti oil brush, but that's not really what's going on. She's very adamantly for this. Thing. And of course, those that are anti-pipeline, Bold Nebraska is one of the groups, and there will be a group of new landowners impacted, and that's going to take another chunk of time. How long has this been? Is it 12 years?
Mm-hmm.
So all of those landowners will be notified what the impacts are on that, but somebody from Bold Nebraska said, of course, we're going to fight like hell. we would expect nothing less from groups like Bold Nebraska. Do not fight like hell for this pipeline. So,
yeah, it's...
Or against, sorry. Right. I said for, against. I mean against.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. It seems like, you know, every time one of these pipeline projects comes up, it's like, really? We're still talking about this? Because the U.S. is still flush with cheap gas and oil from fracking. And say mm-hmm. what you want about fracking, and you can say a lot, but it is infinitely cheaper than the oil you get from the bitumen, which is still like the dirtiest of dirty oil mm-hmm. and is still difficult to get to and only really worthwhile developing if oil is $70, $80, $90 a barrel, which it still isn't, you know, almost 3 years later. It still is not back up to that levels. And you have Rachel Notley, you know, I think maybe in part for her own political fortunes, hoping on a wing and a prayer that it's going to bounce back, because so much of Alberta's economy is tied to that. Jason Kenney not helping the situation either, because, you know, Rachel Notley, I mean, Rachel Notley's trapped between a rock and a hard place, because if you're NDP, you're pretty much anti-pipeline unless you live in Alberta. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even Saskatchewan. But since they're in power in Alberta, you know, she's trapped between incredibly difficult. And we've had NDP people on the show before who've tried to thread the needle ever so delicately. I mean, people like Peter Julian I guess Nikki Ashen as well, you know, it's like, well, you know, they're all, yeah, it's about oil, but it's also about green jobs and this and that and the other thing. So it's incredibly delicate. The thing I find interesting is that TransCanada, like their bad behavior, they tried to go up and over and around this process, this public service commission process. They wanted all that land seized in eminent domain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, this is where kind of like right-wing craziness about land rights
yeah.
works in our favor, because they're like, well, you're not getting my land. And
it's that weird crossover between indigenous rights and land rights. Because they're like, you know,
yeah,
it's my, get off my property.
Yeah.
Especially with that pipeline that's going to spill.
Yeah. And that's kind of the speaking of that break. That was almost a week ago now. They still have no idea where it cracked, where it's broken, where to fix it.
It's difficult with underground.
It's underground. So it looks like this big black splotch in the middle of farmland. Mm-hmm. So, it's they don't know where the leak is, although they've like, well, we've cleaned it up. We've done it. You know, we've done the right thing. We've cleaned it up. It's all packed away. It's all good. And
nothing to see here.
Nothing to see.
Put your drone away. Don't fly over it again.
Yeah, it's like there's no more black spots for you to drone film, chase guys. And it's the most predictable problem there is. The flip side of it too is they want to paint that all these trucks and trains carrying oil. I mean, that's not great either. But I actually read an article where somebody said like, there's no comparison. Yeah, there's more of a chance of an accident with a truck or a train, but the amount of oil spilled is minuscule as compared to the amount of oil spilled when a pipeline ruptures.
But then, of course, there's the Megantic scenario, which is the worst-case scenario where...
Lake Megantic was literally the worst-case scenario because it wasn't so much the oil, it was the fact they had one guy looking after a whole train of oil.
But that is how they roll. So
that is
how they roll. The most for, and I'm not saying it's right, but that they want the most for the least. And if you had more stringent regulations on all of it, the pipelines, the trucks, the trains, and putting money in infrastructure and preventative stuff for spills, then maybe they'd have a better shot at it, right?
Right.
I think it's entirely possible to engineer and take care of a pipeline and monitor it and make sure the damn thing isn't going to leak. This is the problem. They do it because they can get away with it. And that's
right.
That's basic capitalism, right? It's like, let's spend the least amount of money. How can we make the most? And some farmland gets dirtied or 49 people in Quebec pass away. We don't care. And therein lies the problem. Because if they built pipelines that didn't leak at all, this wouldn't be an issue. Everybody would be like, sure, bring it on. Put it right through my property.
That's capitalism 101, folks.
Well, it in my opinion, that's what it is. That's all it is, because they don't want to spend a dime more than they have to.
Yeah, of course.
To get her done. So this, why is it an issue? It's because the thing leaks. If it was just passing by you every day, like, hey, there's a pipeline or whatever, you wouldn't care. We've talked about this before. I say, you know, you can send people to space and bring them back in one piece, no problem. But yes, their spacesuits don't leak, but the pipeline just leaks, right?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, and if it was above ground.
It's 40 years old. Or it's 50 years old. We've all got leaks at 50 years old, huh? Right?
And yeah, it's.
You'll know what I'm talking about in 20 years, kids. Yeah.
But, kids, ask your parents about leaking. There's a. But you're the added difficulty is, yeah, it's also underground. It's also that when there is a leak and it's visible where the leak comes up and where it's visibly affecting the environment, and it gives you an idea of where the leak is, and then they still can't find it. And then there's the fact that all this pipe runs through the middle of nowhere in a lot of places.
Yep.
And if you're, you know, if you're...
Which isn't so bad, unless you live in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
unless
if you're in a house and the pipe under your sink is leaking, you will hear it because you're in your bathroom or your kitchen or wherever, sure, every day. There's not a lot of people who are going to walk past like the middle of farmers' fields or the middle of the Great Plains where this, yeah, where something is leaking, and they're going to see a big black blotch underground.
Yeah,
and this is the core problem to all this. And then on top of it all, the new route, which was like the least ecologically, I guess, dangerous to have the pipeline on, which was their justification for choosing this route, it goes right over the Agola Aquifer.
And that's where it'll break.
Oh, no.
I mean, I'm not saying I want it to, but that'll be like, oh, no, it'll be fine. We can see it. It's exposed, and then it'll just...
But that's like the water source for the Great Plains, this big aquifer under
the Great... And that's the same with this spill, too. It goes into the water table. It's not just like, brr, okay, it's in the dirt. Remove the dirt. Okay, where do you put the dirt? what do you replace in the hole? Plus, they have to replace that chunk of pipeline.
Yeah.
And then every time you make a joint in a pipe, speaking as a tradesperson, that's where it's going to fail. Generally, unless it's just age, corrosion, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the standards when this was built were less than what the standards will be for the new one. In some ways, you could argue, well, the new pipeline is going to be built to 2017 or whatever standards. Maybe. It's kind of like the oil tank cars too, right? Remember, this crash happened and they're going to get rid of all those, is it 111, whatever the number is, single-walled that are holding hazardous materials. I remember hearing this or reading... back to 1979 when the train crashed in Mississauga, same report. It was like, oh, a little electronic box would have prevented this accident. Oh, we need to improve standards of rail cars. Oh, we need to improve the standards when the trains go through towns. Look what happened, right?
So yeah.
I know we're kind of jumping around a bit from just pipelines, but the whole thing is based on, okay, when this passes through occupied places or arable land or water tables, you know, how are you going to, the technology exists. Why do you not use it? Because you don't have to. So.
Yeah, it's just so dicey. And on top of it all, there is the economic question of, you know, this might have made sense in the early part of the century. But, you know, as we kind of get further and further along in here and, you know, it's like the administration's trying to pump up coal again.
Yeah. Oh, God,
and, you know, where you have more people working at Arby's in the United States than working in the coal industry now.
Yeah.
And the argument that this is about jobs, and yeah, it's going to create thousands of construction jobs, but 50 people are going to be watching over this thing by the time it's over. So you're talking about 50 permanent jobs.
And when the alarm goes off, they're just going to kind of ignore it because it's a false alarm. And then
probably
24 hours later, it's like, oh, the river's polluted. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
we'll clean it up. We promise.
Yeah, one of the biggest water sources in the center of the continent where water doesn't occur in vast amounts. That's fine.
After the spill, it's never, ever right.
No. Nope.
I mean, maybe once the glaciers have come and gone again, then whatever. But, yeah.
Speaking of coming and going... That was teed up nicely. There's a project going on in Toronto right now called the King Street Pilot, and there are sections between about Bathurst and
Jarvis.
Thank you. That are streetcar priority, which means that if you're on streetcar, you will have what should be a relatively smooth ride, no more starting and stopping because cars are being stopped from making left turns onto King. They're being stopped from driving through King as they head south or head north. Interesting, right?
We love trans. We're going to have a whole show.
One of these days. Yeah. But yeah, so we're talking about 65,000 trips in a day. I mean, when you start dealing with some of these numbers, you know, a couple hundred people per trip, you know, this is really kind of eye-opening and makes you think, well, why did it take them so long to try this, to prioritize the streetcars? I've been on the King streetcar.
Yeah.
You've been on the King streetcar.
Yeah, I used to. I was a sometime Torontonian back in the day. So
it's... I haven't been on since they've started the pilot, but I mean, come on, this is, it's crazy how you can, there are times of traffic so bad, you can get out and walk and make it to where you're going before the streetcar gets there.
Yeah, the King streetcar has been problematic for a lot of years. It's the heaviest traveled over route on the TTC, as you said, 65,000 people were, and I think the comparison, because they've done the analysis, was something like 20,000 cars. It's one third. King Street has changed in recent years, I would say, in the past 10 to 20. I think I talked about this before, but I used to have a delivery job in the GTA, delivering car parts. I may not have talked about this, but I used to go to King Street a lot because there used to be the garages were all along there. And I think there's still one or two holdouts in some back streets. But back in the day, it was like a garage and a car lot and parking lots. Now all of those places are condos.
Yeah.
And those people generally, some of them obviously have vehicles. Lots of them don't. Because I remember back in the day, I think the number was 50,000 trips a day on the King streetcar, however many years ago. It's gotten up to this level. And that's what's driving it. Haha, no pun intended. So they've made some improvements. Success or disaster remains to be seen. I think what's going to happen with we should talk about the improvements a bit. So as you said, it's from Bathurst to Jarvis. Cars, and I'm not sure why you would go on King Street for one block.
No.
But you can only pretty much go for one block. There's some exceptions to that. You can drive for a block and then you have to get off of King.
Yeah.
So they make it so you can't just drive along King. And I think the taxis got an exemption. Taxis can go at night.
Taxis have an exemption, yeah.
Uber, sorry. Lyft, sorry, you can't. But the taxis have an exemption, which is also great because, I mean, taxis are transit, regardless of how you slice it.
Yes.
And with the restaurant.
It's car sharing, basically.
Yeah. The restaurants, clubs, et cetera, down there, 3, 4, or 5 people in a taxi, you know, that's pretty good. So definitely a long time coming. I think the last time I was down there, there was and this is what happens when it gets backed up. All it would take is like one car turning left and the streetcar grinds to a halt. So you've got 60 more people waiting. And then what happens is the streetcars themselves pile up. I remember seeing a four streetcar backlog on King.
Oh, I've seen a four streetcar. Yeah.
Where it's just like they're just traveling in this. It almost looks like a train as they're traveling along. So some tinkering was needed. Not everyone happy. Some of the restaurants not happy.
Well,
I guess you can't do the grab and go because you're not allowed to park on King while this is ongoing.
Right.
And of course, who isn't happy? Doug Ford.
Ugh.
He's calling the tickets that people are getting, which is a $110 fine and 2 points for doing the wrong turn or not following the King rules, the Tory ticket. So
Bravo. Is
he running for mayor? Has he actually said that he's running
well,
for mayor?
He announced at Ford Fest he was.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he can't do the paperwork until May.
I should run for mayor, but
yeah, he can't do the paperwork until May 1st.
May 1 is the
and I think there's some question about whether or not his campaigning now is strictly legal. But yeah,
I guess he can say what you want. But if you say as mayor, you can't say that. But he can say
he said he's going to cancel. He's going to scrap it. First of all, this is a pilot. Second of all, by the time in the unlikely event he's elected mayor. By the time he's put in office, the pilot will be over.
Yeah.
So this is going to come back to council anyway.
Although he was second to Tory last time, wasn't he?
Yeah. But, I mean, he was also riding the coattails of his brother. He was also riding...
But of the 19 candidates, I mean, he did the best. So, but anyway, that's another
story.
Well,
he did the best against... Yeah, he did the best against Tory. My point is that he doesn't have Rob to lean on anymore.
No.
It's going to be the Doug Ford show, and it's going to be a... Fuster cluck, to say the least. But yeah,
well played. Yes.
But yeah, I agree that the Tory ticket, I mean, that's great. great alliteration there. And that alliteration and Doug Ford are words I never thought I'd use in the same sentence. But
or
the,
literate, but that's just my opinion. That's my opinion. Sorry. The views expressed.
But the restaurant thing I found odd. The guy that was quoted in this Sun article, his name was Tony Ellenis. And somebody dug up that he's never owned a restaurant. He's owned a lot of restaurants, but he's never owned a restaurant in downtown Toronto. So he's, I'm not sure to what degree he's talking out of his, this is something he's getting feedback. But I mean, there's no way that you can judge like we're down 20-30%, which was the number that was bandied about in that Sun article. That, you know, that after 1 week, you're like, you're being slaughtered. And it isn't just the Sun either. There was the CBC article on the first day where they interviewed this couple who lives in a condo over King, and it's like, we're looking down, and it looks like it's a disaster. It's a disaster. Like, they're watching the rising tide come in or something. It's just bizarre.
But as condo people there, and if there's less traffic, you could probably walk across King without getting beamed by a car, which is something that happens regularly down there.
Well, I will admit, and I think this was Edward Keenan who pointed out in his column that, you know, pedestrians have to do their part too, because you have a lot of people who will dart across the road while the red hand is flashing, yeah. But you got to watch out for the cars now, because the cars only have that limited time to make that turn. And they can't turn left anymore. Right. Well, as always, but I mean, as pedestrians, you have a responsibility as well. I always try to observe, like, not trying to cross the road on the red hand flashing. I don't always succeed, I admit. But pedestrians in downtown Toronto do have to be a bit more aware too that the limited opportunities for drivers now too, and that's a legit criticism.
Yeah, because it wasn't King; it was Bloor actually, where I got hit by a taxi. My first sort of. Getting bumped, and the guy just drove off. So,
do you have the scar? Do you want to? I would say show us the scar.
Let's just say the air was blue with some foul language. But
interesting,
I was a young man then, so you can bounce back. I think if I got hit by a taxi now, I don't know what I would do. But you're right; the pedestrians have to look out, especially you know, we talked about before about the distracted pedestrians. But King is just so heavy now.
Give him a ticket.
People are going, yeah, exactly. Ticket them all. So traffic's going to the side streets. The challenge, I think, is going to be people who don't know that Adelaide is one way going east and Richmond is one way west. Those streets always generally seem to have good flow back in the day. I haven't driven in Toronto in a while.
Last time I was there, I think people tend to use King and Queen, and they don't use the streets in between.
And when, like I said, when I was doing deliveries, that was a while ago. But those streets were great if you knew about them. And that's the thing I think people are going to try and go down to Toronto because their GPS says, oh, I need to go here to get the Princess of Wales or something on King Street. And they'll just drive by there not knowing, and then a cop will jump out and... I don't know. I mean, the fine is one thing. Demerit points? I don't think this merits demerit points, really. I mean, No merit for demerit. You don't merit demerit points. There's a tongue twister for you. I think the demerit points is a bit much, but I don't particularly agree with Mayor Hopeful, Doug Ford, or others, the Toronto Sun.
Well, like, Mammalady was on.
Mammalady,
there's
more in the car.
Yeah. Oh, the car? That drove me bonkers. He called it, they're trying to run the car right out of the city. There's a full war on.
The city is designed for cars.
Yeah, but.
Toronto is designed for cars.
But someone wrote this in the Star. It wasn't Keenan. But it was somebody else who writes about city issues.
Was it John Lornick, maybe? That's my guess.
I can't remember. He says, caught between a capacity, Toronto's caught between its capacity as a proper big city and behaving like a provincial town trapped in a 1955 dream, which...
That's pretty good.
Which perfectly describes Doug Ford, first of all.
Bring back the Red Rockets!
But... It's right, you know. You have a high density area, and it's just getting more dense. And you can't have like the same attitude you have even in downtown Guelph, where you're going to drive downtown, you're going to get a parking spot as close to the place you want to go, and you're going to run in and do the thing. It's just you can't do that in a city of 3 million people, and Toronto is having to reckon with that. Otherwise, you're stuck in a car, you're stuck in a streetcar trying to get where you're going, and you're the fifth streetcar back from a series of five streetcars.
Yeah,
and you're all going at the exact same speed, and then you hit a an intersection, you're waiting for someone to turn left, and then the light turns, and then you got to stop as soon as you get across the street to pick up the next batch of people.
Yep.
And that's 5 minutes out of your day.
Because this was something they tried to alleviate with the Spadina line, and you've seen it where the Spadina line is in the middle, but Spadina Road was designed pretty much with the streetcar in mind, the modern version of it anyway, where you've got like a transit way in the middle and then the traffic on either side, and that works. And that was a great disruption when it was put in, but it's one of those things where the disruption is there, and then when everything goes back to normal, kind of like Wilson Street in town here. I mean, is it going to be, there's still parking out front. It's probably going to be fine. There was a little bit of a whatever. But in the long run, the design changes are probably for the better. Now, whether this pilot project is going to solve the issue, and, you know, some of the rules might be made permanent, maybe not all of them. But police enforcement ends next week. And when that happens, it's like, does it all fall apart?
Yeah.
That's what remains to be seen.
Speaking of disruption, we'll have to disrupt the show because it's over.
It's time. Wow, there you go.
Anyway, you can stay connected with our website, opensourceswealth.com. Go to Facebook, Open Sources Newswire, and at @OS_Guelph on the Twitters. And you can hear this and past episodes of the show on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean and subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
Nailed it.
For once. Next week I'll be blogging at who knows what.
DJ Sounds Good to Me is up next here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources, and we will see you then.